So today's speaker is Daniel Morimaya, whose name is a combination of Morris and Pugmire, I understand. But he called himself Mori. Makes it a bit easier. And he's speaking to us, well, he is the Community Food Sovereignty Lead at the Environmental Network Manawatū, which is an umbrella organisation serving about 65 different global environmental groups. Mori has had a varied career. He worked as an avionics technician in the New Zealand Air Force for 7 years, and then he went to Massey for a degree in zoology and ecology, and also trained as a teacher, taught for a while at a Montessori school, and was also involved in Kura Kupapa Māori. Now, food sovereignty is one of the Environmental Network's main concerns. It involves such activities as community gardens and food sharing. Mori is especially concerned with empowering people to grow and control their own food systems. And true to his principles, he lives rurally with his wife in Four Tamariki, and a developing food forest, small orchards, and an expanding series of raised gardens. So to hear more, please welcome Mori.
Kura, tēnā tātou. Tuatahi, he mihi ana ki a koutou katoa, o tō tai mai I tēnei wahi, he mihi nui ki te pari I tēnei. Ko wai au. Ko wai au, ko Daniel Morimaya tōku ingoa, ko Mori tāku ingoa karanga. Nō Ingarangi ōku tīpuna, I tipu aki au I Tauranga Moana, ingeri ke te noho au I Papahoia nāianei. So just to give a bit of a background, as he so eloquently mentioned, my last name is a combination of Morris, which was my given surname when I was born, and Pagamaya, which is my wife's name, and so we made them into Morimaya. And another bit of context here, so I'm married to the granddaughter of Sue and Faye Burns, who have both sadly passed away, but some of you might have known them. They were involved in the Floral Art Club and a number of other clubs in Palmerston North. I grew up in Tauranga, but I live now in Palmerston North here. And again, I work for Environment Network Manawatū as a lead in the community food sovereignty area there. My computer's died, so I just have to sign in while I... Here we go. So today what I would really like to talk to you about is a bit of a research collaboration that we did with Massey University, how it came about. You're going to be one of the first groups to see the end results of that collaboration, so you're very special. And hopefully it'll be interesting, and I can give a bit more background depth to some of the thoughts and ideas that come through this resource. I'm just going to hold it up very briefly now. So this is the resource that was produced in a one-page format. I don't expect any of you to be able to read it from here, but it's up here for people to look at, particularly after morning tea, afternoon tea, sorry, and I am going to be showing the slides one by one on the screen, so hopefully you'll see them. Now, is there anyone here who can't quite see visually very well? Because I'm happy to do a description of the slides as they come up, of the pictures particularly. I might do a brief one just to in case anyone doesn't want to speak up. But I'll start through the slides now. So I'm going to start off really boring, and I'm going to give you some definitions, and I'm going to use my teacher background here. And I will read them out again just in case you can't read. So food insecurity is a big issue, and you've probably heard the word a number of times in different contexts. What does it mean? So a definition that we have get from the internet that a lot of government agencies use is it's when people do not have consistent access to enough safe and nutritious food for a healthy life. It can be short term, so like after disaster, maybe kind of COVID-19, people can't get to the supermarkets, or it could be long term, more systemic and issues related around poverty, for example. So food security is a step up. Food security is a good thing. It's when all people at all times have access to enough safe, nutritious and culturally acceptable food to live an active and healthy life. So again, kind of this is a plain version of saying that if people can reliably get enough food they need. Something like I'd like to add on to here, which someone brought up as a bit of an analogy a while ago when I originally did a presentation like this, is that people in prison have food security. So that means they get enough food to eat, and all the nutrition they need, but they don't have any control over the food at all. So that's going to be important for the next step. So when we talk about food resilience, again, this is where people have enough food at all times, but they also are resilient to shocks in supply. So that can be that. The ability of food system to withstand shocks, i.e. kind of climate events, price shocks, and ensure people still have enough access to food. So a food system that keeps working even when things go a little bit wrong. The next one is food sovereignty. So this is the maunga tete. This is like the pinnacle that a lot of people aspire for. So food sovereignty is the right of communities and peoples to control their own food systems, including how food is grown, distributed, and consumed, using sustainable and culturally appropriate methods. So again, a plain version is people decide not only kind of they don't only not only get enough food to eat, but they control and decide how their food is grown and shared. So again, though, that's kind of like a high level kind of aim there, and it's a bit of a inner definition. And that's a lot of words, and that's coming from a particular context. And what I'd like to say is that these definitions are kind of limited. So they don't fully reflect local content. These are kind of used worldwide. They're very overarching, but they don't give a lot of local context. They can be a bit arbitrary and hard for individuals to relate to. They lack Indigenous worldviews, and that's only part of the puzzle that makes up our food systems. And so I had an idea, and this is what we're sharing today, of kind of trying to create a resource that can explain and kind of make clear some of these concepts and give people the space to talk about them in a constructive way and think about how we want to reshape our food systems, because a lot of people agree that our food systems are broken in many ways. And so we wanted to share a resource. So what we're sharing today is I'm sharing with you a resource developed through this collaboration to acknowledge the collective mahi behind it and the people involved, and also to kind of give you opportunities of kind of what to do next. Like, it's all well and good me showing you this resource, talking about it, but what actions can then happen as a result of it. So this project started, and this is kind of a couple of screenshots from the slide that I had in one of the regular hui that I ran a number of years ago, and it was talking about what do people need in order to survive. This is talking about like a big picture evolutionary thing, and I'm going to read it out here. So people need air, people need water, people need food, and people need shelter. These are the basic fundamentals of what people need for life. And I'm kind of leaving beside all the emotional stuff at the moment, so this is just the physical things. And interestingly enough, for 95% of human history, those are things that we've all provided for ourselves in the context of, I'd say, small groups of hunter-gatherers. So humans have been around for over 300,000 years, and it was only about 15,000 years ago that we developed into an agricultural society, and the ways that we get our food have changed dramatically since then. But since then, there's only 5% of human history, so that's an interesting thing just to keep in mind. So again, based on those kind of couple little slides I had before, I talked to some colleagues, some friends that we had at Massey University, around what we could do to kind of take this really big, slightly hard-to-define idea and bring it into something that's easily accessible for the public and for anyone, no matter what their background is, to talk about and to use. So us as an Environment Network Manawatū, and particularly the Manawatū Food Action Network, which I lead, we shared an interest in food sovereignty, community well-being, and using local solutions for local challenges. And the question I had is, how do we make food sovereignty more accessible and useful for our community? And so luckily enough, the Massey researchers, they applied for a grant and they got it, and they were able to use that to employ a research lead and to run a series of wānanga and help us in the work we do at Environment Network Manawatū. So stage one, again, this is a little bit dry and I assure you I'll get some more interesting things in a moment, but stage one was they reviewed some policy, research and community knowledge. They talked with local stakeholders and organisations, and that's where Environment Network Manawatū came along and made sure we introduced them to the right people at the right time as part of that research. And they focused on what do people already know, what's confusing and hard to apply, and what would actually be useful. And a key principle they used was starting with people, not with theory. stage two was making sense of it together. And so from the research, so looking at the literature reviews, looking at the interviews they did with stakeholders, what were some key ideas using local knowledge, Māori perspectives and Mātauranga, and also using academic knowledge. And they translated complex concepts into clear, relevant messages. And a key principle, again, was co-creation, not extraction. Stage three, now it's starting to get a bit more exciting. There's some colour on these slides. Stage three was creating something useful. So this was the thing where we wanted to develop a community-friendly resource. And at the time, I had this pie-in-the-sky idea. There's this great comic artist I knew called Toby Morris. You might have heard of, he does these awesome comics. Like, wouldn't it be great if we get him? And we kind of went all these ways. And you know what? In the end, we ended up getting him. So that was fantastic using our messy research context. And it's designed to be easily understood, visually engaging, which I think it does really well, and relevant to local experiences. And we'll touch on those there. And it's also a focus on practical understanding, not just the theory. And stage four is sharing and growing. And so this research is now being shared across our networks. All the comics you see today are available through our website, and I'm sure we'll be able to share links for that after this presentation. It's shared within our InFan networks, community organisations, and it's creating lots of opportunities for conversations and for learning and for action. Again, as I say, this is probably the second presentation I've done showing this research resource to people, so you're very special. And I suppose finally, what made this research work? A lot of it comes down to research and trust. Researchers can often seem a little bit unapproachable, but the researchers we work with, we know they're really grounded in community engagement, that they listen to the people in the community and take on their ideas. We also had shared values and purposes. We had a respect for different types of knowledge, both lived experiences as well as academic, as well as cultural, all the different kinds, and everyone was pretty flexible and open in the process. Of this. So without further ado, I'm going to run through the slides here. What I'll do is just to give the proper focus of the resource. There's about 13 slides, so I'll run through them, and I'm going to read out loud what the captions say, just so everyone knows. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to backtrack to the first slide and run through them again with a little bit more commentary around some of the thinking and the ideas behind the slides. So this is the resource here, Rethinking Our Relationship with Kai. It's an illustrated summary of the key findings from the research project Advancing Food Sovereignty in the Manawatū Region, a collaboration between Environment Network Manawatū, Dr. Chrissy Severinson and Dr. Angelique Lewity from Massey University. For many people, food can be a moment-to-moment thing. I get hungry, I buy food. But this kind of relationship with what we eat tends to be short-term, passive, and individual. It's unsustainable and it's reactive. Somebody else is in control. And for those who can't see, there's a picture of a number of people outside what appears to be a supermarket. They're all looking a little bit kind of unhappy, not too excited. Someone's carrying a shopping bag, someone's eating a pie, and they're pretty passive. There is another way. Food sovereignty is about looking at the bigger picture, a more empowering, long-term, community and knowledge-based approach to kai. This can mean learning together, planting community gardens, sharing kai, and reducing food waste. It's about building new ways of thinking locally about food and where it comes from, and how we use it together across generations. And again, a bit of a visual description here. There's a group of people in the foreground who are happy and talking to each other with some gardening tools. And in the background, there's activity going on with people in what seems to be a community garden setting. It's an approach that recognises that food isn't just physical sustenance. It's also about culture, community, empowerment, and fostering a more sustainable relationship with whenua. It's about planting seeds for the future to build relationships, reciprocity and resistance. It's grounded in te reti, in place, and is sustained through collective care for people and the environment. And again, there's a picture here of a couple of people who are planting some trees, and next to them are some signs that say relationships, reciprocity and resistance. And that'll be important later on, we'll find out why. Kai is whakapapa. Kai carries whakapapa, gardens grow people as well as plants. Food sovereignty recognises that food is relational, meaning it's tied into the way we relate to each other, the whenua, atua and our communities. It's the way we show care and connection. Kai is about wairua, whakapapa and connection. It's about people coming together and asking, how do we live well together through kai? And just a description there, that's a couple of people, one of them's handing over a box of what seems to be locally produced food to someone else, again, people looking relatively happy in a community setting. Kai is community. We experience kai not just as individuals, but as a community. Food sovereignty is about sharing, manaakitanga, and collaboration. If you want a village, you have to be a villager. No one person can do it all, and luckily they don't have to. The research shows food sovereignty systems and community sufficiency works best when we work together, for each other sharing skills, seeds and support. And again, there's a picture of a glasshouse, multiple people working together to look after it, with some kids running around having some fun in amongst the community members. Kai is healing. It's not just physical sustenance, it sustains us spiritually and emotionally too. It's a huge part of hauora, healing and meaning. Gardening restores wairua and connection. Food sovereignty recognises that kai is a living system connecting well-being, environment and justice. Kai is knowledge. Over time, some indigenous knowledge about growing food has been lost. Food sovereignty encourages reclaiming and preserving this knowledge and the importance of passing it on to future generations. Starting small and learning together builds confidence and capability. Revival is happening through Mata Kai, seed sharing, school gardens, intergenerational mentoring and community wānanga. And again, the picture here is of what looks like an elderly lady showing a couple of young kids about the properties of a plant or a leaf that she's holding there. Barriers to Kai sovereignty. Realistically, of course, there are barriers. These include people struggling to find time and energy, renters having a lack of stability or control over short-term funding systems and restrictive council rules. Many of these challenges, lack of money, time, access to land, and lack of power, overlap with the broader problems caused by colonialism, capitalism, and a short-term political system more generally. But perhaps recognising this can give clues to overcoming it. And there's a picture of several people from a whānau there looking through a chain link fence locked out of the kind of garden and produce on the side of the fence. Kai is local, but local isn't always sovereign. Manawatū has food abundance, yet not everyone has equal access to that food. Local food initiatives like community gardens, marae mata, community auctions and pātaka kai show place-based leadership. Local doesn't always mean sovereign. Effective local food systems need to centre mana whenua leadership and be accessible and fair for all community members. Again, there's a picture here of a couple of people standing in front of what looks to be the Arapotahi Bridge in the background on the Manawatū River here. Kai is mana motuhake, building independence, reclaiming the relationship of land and preserving knowledge. The goals and methods of food sovereignty overlap with Māori aspirations of sovereignty more broadly. The research is clear that decolonisation and tino rangatiratanga are central to any claims of food sovereignty. It needs to be Māori-led, Māori communities defining their own systems according to tikanga and whakapapa. And again, there's a picture here of a group of people who are harvesting some trees, harvesting some apples from an orchard. Kai is intergenerational. Food sovereignty efforts need funding for the long term too. Intergenerational knowledge sharing and community building will help build food systems that will last long into the future for Okapuna and for Te Tai Ao, the environment. Getting rangatahi involved and recognising Te Tai Ao, including whenua, moana and atua, are the keys to sustaining sovereignty. And again, the picture here is a group of people contributing to what looks to be an outside shared kai, they're bringing along food and everyone looking happy and involved in the community. Growing a sovereign future together. Food sustains us and it also brings us together, now and in the future. Seeds of new systems that we plant now need to be planted with an eye on the long term. Food sovereignty is a change in attitude, but one that will bear results for everyone. More confident, stronger communities, a more sustainable relationship with the environment, and more knowledge and independence. Relationships, reciprocity, and resistance. And again, there's a picture here of a group of people enjoying a shared quiet table, and we now see the fully grown trees that you may have noticed earlier on in the cartoon series, saying relationships, reciprocity, and resistance. And so that is it. That is the resource. And again, it's based on Dr. Chrissy Severinsen and Dr. Angeline Gewitty from the School of Health Sciences, Massey University. And the comic adaptation, as I mentioned, is by Toby Morris. You'll probably recognise every time you go into a new world, if you see the food, they often have a little kind of sign saying, put your food here to kind of donate to a local food charity. He's the one that does the illustrations and the comics for that. He's also done, I think, a couple of quite well-known books on Tiriti, and I think he does a lot of cartoon series on the spin-off website. What I'm going to do now, though, so that's the brief resource, and just like to say that's available to anyone. We have it on our website for people to see, but we also have digital versions if anyone's interested in having it for any other community meetings. We're very happy to kind of give permission for people to use that. But I'm just going to back to the beginning of this, and I'm going to talk a bit more in depth about some of the slides and some of the links it has to real-life community projects that are going on in the Manawatu at the moment. So I'm going to go back to this first slide here, and I think some of the underlying thoughts and reasons behind this slide I'm going to go into, and this is a really big thing, and that is for the majority of us, our day-to-day food systems have been commercialised, and they are commercial. Food is an industry, and it's an industry worth big dollars. Many people under a certain age have only ever had the experience of getting food through shops and takeaways, and to them food is just another commodity. Can I ask who here grew up being able to grow food at home with a garden or something? Probably most of you. If I had the same audience, and let's say we kept the age of the audience at 40, I don't reckon, I think maybe a quarter of the people probably put their hands up. It's been a real big shift in generations, the access and what the knowledge people have around where food comes from. We've all heard those stories of kind of asking a child, oh, where did the carrots come from? Oh, they come from the supermarket. No, but where did they come from before the supermarket? Oh, they come from the truck. It's like they often lack that kind of understanding. And so that's something that's, there's a lot of groups who are working on that, and I'll come on to them in a moment. So again, kind of talking about food sovereignty as a whole, it's a concept, and it's a concept that is a lot wider than just food as a commodity, and I think that's the real key message here. And I'm going to talk about it a bit more in other slides, is that there is an alternative to seeing food as a commodity, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And food is more than food. Again, this is, I think, what this slide here is talking about, is that, yes, food is something, it's a physical object that we all need to eat or we will die if we don't get it, but there's so much context around food. It's history, it's flavour, it's relationships, it contains culture, it's got skills, there's hands-on activity. Food is something that's universal to us all, no matter what our background is, and there's so much history around food. Whatever food you'd like to take, you could probably read 20 pages on Wikipedia about the history of it and where it comes from and people's different interpretations of it. So food is huge. And another thing I'd like to share, and this is kind of going on from my last one, I'll go to Kaya's Whakapapa, is that when I talked about food as a commodity, the alternative to food as a commodity would be thinking of food as part of the gifting economy, is something I'd like to talk to. Has anyone here heard of Robin Wall Kimmerer? She's a famous American botanist and author. She's a Native American from the Potawatomi tribe, and she's written several books, including Braiding Sweetgrass and The Service Berry. And when she talks about food as part of the gifting economy, and I think it comes down to this, it's when we talk about relationships, if you go to the shop and you hand over your $2 to the shopkeeper and you get your 3 carrots, that's a transaction and it's done. You don't feel any need to kind of, if you're polite, you'll probably thank the person, say thank you, and you'll go away, but you won't feel any need to carry on that relationship after it. If you go to, let's say, a community garden, and there's a Pātaka Whai there, and there's a little bag of carrots, and it says, free to anyone, you take those carrots, you've started a relationship now, you'll probably, next time you go past, you might think, maybe I need to go home. I've got a spare can in the cupboard, and I'll come and put it back in the part I could buy for someone else. Or maybe a week later, you'll walk past and think, oh, that needs gardening. There's a few weeds in that weed there, and I'll pull them out. Or, look, there's a working bee coming up. So when food is part of a gifting economy, it creates and maintains relationships between people. And that's a hugely important thing that we've lost when we think about food as just a commodity. So kind of a line up here that I stole from someone, and I can't remember who, is that food has been a means not just for nourishment, but it's been a glue for holding communities together, forming bonds of reciprocity. And so Kai's community, and in my opinion at the moment, we're on a bit of a knife edge in some ways, and I think there's going to be a huge shift in the way that communities think about and access Kai. So we're finding for our network, more and more people are interested in growing food at home. It was probably normal for most of you when you were growing up. Is it normal now? But it's becoming more normalised thanks to the work of many, many groups in the community. People are attending working bees at community gardens and regaining the skills that it seems to have been passed over a couple of generations, those kind of really inherent useful skills around preserving food, cooking food, following recipes, knowing what's seasonal and using seasonal ingredients in what we're cooking. Those are things that most of you here probably possibly take for granted, but they aren't common in a lot of people under 40 today, but it's something that's coming back. So the slide about Kai is healing, and a lot of you might have heard some phrases around food is like medicine, or you are what you eat, and the list goes on and on. And it can be a tricky area to think about, because studies seem to come and go and change every year on what's good for you and what's not good for you, and is it kind of a low salt diet, or food and nutrition is a very complex matter. But something that tends to be a trend that people are going back to is actually less is more in some ways, and less processed food that's grown naturally, food that's grown locally, fresh fruit and vegetables is something that pretty much most nutrition, I'd say all nutritionists would agree on, is better for you than things like ultra processed foods. So that's just kind of, again, although there's some arguments about specifics around nutrition, that's a pretty, I'd say, general thing that most people would agree on, is that less processed is better than ultra-processed foods. And by supporting the types of food sovereignty ideas we're talking about, where we're advocating for people to grow food at home, advocating for community gardens, it's going to produce and have a lot more accessible to the community that types of really good, healthy, freshly produced food, as opposed to just having like a packet of chips or biscuits at the supermarket that people access. Again, kind of through our network, Environment Network with Manawatu, we advocate for methods that grow kind of locally grown without the use of pesticides, synthetic fertilizers, and dare I say gene editing. And this is going back to what humans have evolved to eat in the vast 95% of our evolutionary history. Remember what I said about kind of how long humans have been evolved for, have been around for. So the 95% of our evolutionary history, wheat was something that people didn't have because we were hunter-gatherers, and wheat was not something that people would really effectively go and hunt-gatherer because it wasn't worth the time and effort. It was only since the advent of agriculture and breeding for kind of certain traits and plants that we had access to those kinds of foods. Kai is knowledge. So again, I'm going to harken back to our growing food as part of our growing up. Many of you here would have had growing food as part of your history growing up, whether it was going out and collecting eggs from the chickens at the beginning of the day, looking after the garden, picking the fruit from the orchards whenever it's kind of autumn. That's something that has been lost for many people. And unfortunately, unfortunately that's a fact, but fortunately there are many groups and many people who are working out there to try and bring that knowledge back. And just like a very brief mention of a lot of groups we support, and apologies if I leave any out, but we have Plant Plate, who work in schools to both do the planting and looking after the food, and then at the end of it they come back and they do workshops on how to grow the food. So there's some people, there's a lot of volunteers who are really passionate who work in that space there. We have RECAP, which over in Ashurst and Pohongana is a group of people who are really looking at passing on knowledge and giving people the skills and opportunities to grow food at home and in community settings. super grands are doing really wonderful work in teaching people not only things that, like, not only sewing and looking after the household, like cooking, preserving a lot of skills around food that have been lost. And virus schools are doing great work with schools too, and many, many, many other individuals and volunteers in our community who are working and advocating around Kai. And again, we'll come later on when we talk about options. There are lots of opportunities out there for anyone to be involved. And it doesn't matter if you're not physically strong, it might be up here what's really needed out in the community. Again, this is barriers to Kai sovereignty, and this is something that there's a lot to be said about and there's a lot of debate over. And I'm going to use an analogy here and then I'm going to pull it apart. So who has heard of the phrase, give a man a fish, he'll eat for a day, teach a man how to fish, he'll eat for a lifetime? That's a nice thought behind it, and it seems to make a lot of sense on the surface, but then you dig a little bit deeper. What if you can't access the sea or the river? What if you need a permit to fish and you don't have the money for the permit? What if you've been taught how to fish but you can't afford or don't have the equipment? Oh, the list here, well, I guess next to... what if there's pollution and the fish are unsafe to eat? What if the fish population has been decimated by fishing companies and there's no fish left in there? What if the government is going to pass a regulation saying it's unsafe to catch any fish caught by anyone other than a registered licensed fisherman, and it's now illegal and you'll be fined if you catch a fish? So the last one was a made-up one, but it's not actually too far from the truth from what could be happening today. So it's all well and good giving people the knowledge on how to do something, but you also have to make sure they can actually put it into practice. And it's something I've been working in some other projects around Every Bite, which is around giving people skills how to reduce food waste at home. But there's a bit of psychology. It's called behaviour change theory. And there's a, I think it's like a pyramid, a three-point pyramid to do with behaviour change. And it's what do people do? And what people do is based on what they think, what they have, and some external influences too. So it might be all well and good teaching someone how to fish using the same analogy, but if you don't give them the equipment of how to fish, then they won't do it. It's all good giving them the equipment how to fish, but if you haven't taught them how to do it, they're going to go fishing and they won't catch anything. Or you can give them the equipment and teach them how to fish, but then if all of their peers are saying, oh no, don't catch fish, it's yucky, or don't go there, you're not allowed. That's a combination of all these factors. And so behaviour change relies on people having the knowledge, having the ability, and also having the support from their wider community to do things. So talking about Kai is local. So again, the Manawatū has an abundance of Kai. So anyone who's been anywhere outside know that we're a really great region for producing a lot of food, along with the Horowhenua. The lower half of North Island is fantastic. Actually, most of New Zealand is, to be honest. But most of it's meant for export and is part of that kind of industrialised, export-orientated economy. And we don't actually have the range of commercial crops to cover our basic dietary requirements in the Manawatū region. I don't know if any of you saw, but I think it was maybe a year ago, a year and a half ago, there was a headline that came up of kind of how Palmerston North could survive a nuclear winter. And I can provide this the link to this later on, but some researchers from somewhere, which I don't know, they used Manawatū as an example of a mid-sized landlocked city of 91,000 people, and they looked at what our capacity was to produce our own food to feed our entire population. It was in a situation where it was like a post kind of large global disruption of supply chains. The good news was we can. Actually, in Palmerston North, we can produce enough feed to feed all of our population using our urban boundaries, plus I think a kilometre extra around the outside. And that would be using all our golf clubs and parks and things, basically turning them all into community gardens and planting a lot of peas in the outskirts of the city. So we could do it, but it was just a really interesting kind of thought exercise in what we could do and actually what could happen if the worst came to the worst. And I think, again, they said they found here peas and potatoes suit the Manawatū climate conditions. Sugar beet, spinach, wheat and carrots would be more efficient during a nuclear winter scenario. So let's fingers crossed that doesn't happen, but interesting to know if someone's looked at that. So, Kai is mana motuhaki. And again, I don't know, this could be a challenge to some of you, or couldn't, depending on your worldviews and your upbringing, or what experiences have shaped your life. I'm Pakeha. My parents came from England in the 1960s. And I didn't have a lot to do with Te Ao Māori, probably until my early 20s. And it was around about that time I had a bit of an epiphany. And I think this was when I was studying at Te Wānanga of Aotearoa. And it was around the word kaitiakikatanga, which a lot of you have probably heard. And this is just my interpretation of it. And apologies for any mana whenua if I have this wrong. But my interpretation was that land ownership wasn't a thing that existed before Pākehā came to New Zealand. It just wasn't a thing. So any people who mention it as Māori gave away ownership into Te Tiriti is absolute rubbish because it didn't exist. It was all about kaitiakikatanga, which is looking after the land. And so if you look at Te Tiriti, what happened is that Māori gave the crown the right to be kaitiaki, to be guardians of the land. And so they weren't actually trading away ownership of the land. But that is the world we live in these days, where a lot of Māori, a lot of iwi do not own the land. That were their traditional hunting, gathering, foraging grounds that allowed them to collect kai for themselves. And so that's a direct result of colonisation. And I think what I've used before was an analogy. It doesn't have to be New Zealand, but let's go 20,000 years into the past and pick up a competent hunter-gatherer person living in society, then pluck them up and come and put them down today somewhere in an urban setting anywhere in the world. And I don't think they're going to do too well in most cases. Where would they go to hunt or to gather or to forage? If they try going to a supermarket and there's all this food, they take it out, they're going to find out, oh, there's a thing called money and I don't have any. They might go into a property, oh, there's some nice apples, oh, there's this thing called land ownership and acres won't be there. It's quite a tricky situation, and we have changed a lot as humans and what we've evolved to expect, the ways we've traditionally operated in society and what we are now. So sometimes the problem isn't and the solutions aren't quite as easy and simplistic as some people would have you think. This is something I'd like to put there. So the next slide is kai is intergenerational. And again, that's a key message we've heard, and one that I'd like to emphasise again, is that many of you here from a generation where you have passed on the skills from your parents and grandparents. So I'm just going to do a bit of a show of hands here, just for interest. So who here could cook a base on it? I'm going to do it even simpler. Who here could go to the supermarket and buy some food to eat? Most of you, hopefully. Who here could cook a basic meal using a recipe, let's say England's cookbook? Most of you. Who here can cook a meal just from your memory? Who here knows how to preserve food using either stewing, drying, dehydrating, doesn't have to be all of these, just one, bottling, canning, or fermenting? Any one of those? Most people, yeah? Yeah. Who here knows how to could grow, let's say, some carrots or some kind of staple crop in the garden? Yeah. And who here could grow your own food in the garden, harvest it seasonally, possibly preserve it, and cook it in a meal? See, that's the game. See, this is the knowledge we've got in this room here, and this is the knowledge that is lost for a lot of younger generations. So the good news is that there's a lot of people out there who are working on passing on this knowledge. I bet many of you in here are probably involved in some organisations. Many of you in here could be involved in some of those organisations. And so kai is growing a sovereign future together. So again, this is the final slide, and I'd like to take note of the trees here. So right at the beginning, I'm going to kind of zoom back. One of these first ones, see, they're planting the seeds of relationship, reciprocity, and resistance. So there's a little trees that have only just been planted. And by the end of this comic series, there are great big trees there. So this is part of, I think, a visual representation of the fact that the kaupapa and the thoughts behind this aren't short-term. They're not little things. These are really big things. So they're going to take a long time to bear fruit, but they're really important. And I think by planting the seeds now, hopefully we will kind of, as I say, prepare our future for a lot better food security system, food sovereignty system than we have now. So I'm going to go on to the next steps here as actions. And these are just some things for you to think about and kind of cogitate on. So what can you do as an individual? What can you do as a whānau? What can you do as a community member? And potentially for some of you, what can you do as a person in a position of power or privilege in your community? I'm not going to give you the answers. Those are just questions for you to think on. I do have some other potential ideas, and this could be for anyone, because a lot of people, when they're faced with a problem like the perceived brokenness of our food system, there's not a lot any individual person can do for the whole system, but there are little actions that add up, and particularly they add up if all of us take them, or even if we're just kind of cognizant of what the actions we do and what effects they have. So the first one is, it's an election year. I'm not going to tell you who to vote for, but I do want you all to vote, and I'm sure most of you probably will. Spend some time looking into what policies the different parties have on Thai and on food systems. For example, are they supportive of community initiatives? Are they focused on food for all people, or are they more focused on Thai as the economic driver of prosperity, i.e. an export-dominated kind of model? Other ideas you can find a local group to volunteer for. That's something I've hinted at a number of times today, and I'm very happy to give people some context to follow up with. You can purchase local kai, which supports local farmers and growers and local groups who are growing food locally. I'm almost at my end now. This is maybe the second to last slide, but I'm going to read out something here. This is, doing mine on this one here. So actions, potential ideas, I've already said all these, the right to food. And so this is taken directly from a New Zealand government website, and I'm going to read it out because, as many of you know, we don't really quite have a constitution in New Zealand, but we have signed up to the UN Rights for People, and this is a very explicit statement in there that the New Zealand governments have agreed to, and no one has taken it back. As yet. Everyone has the right to adequate food. That means the government must ensure that people can grow, produce, or get food for themselves and their families. When people are unable to feed themselves, the government must provide them with food. In Aotearoa New Zealand, human rights, including the right to adequate food, must give effect to Te Tiriti o Waitangi. So that's there in writing on the government website if anyone wishes to see it, and I think that is quite a challenge to a lot of people, because for many people that is not the reality they see when they deal with government agencies. It's not the reality we hear when we hear politicians talking about what their responsibilities are. So I think that's just something very interesting to think about. And again, I'd like to go back to the barriers of food sovereignty. The government sets many policies and many regulations. Often they're good, sometimes they might not be. And as an example, around food, there's often a very perceived, there's talk around food safety. And I think there's a balance between, let's say, selling milk at a farm gate, which is something that most of you have heard of as a thing, and many of you may have grown up kind of going to your local dairy farm and getting a thing of milk from their milking shed, which everyone did, and you're still here, so none of you died, I don't think, from that there. But just as a small example, there's many rules and regulations around food that's made in the name of food safety that many people think are not actually for the purpose of food safety, but is to, I think, solidify the power structures in food and who has the power and who has the control. And I think that's something that's very important to be aware of. And again, kind of in terms of the right for food, it's all good. If you say people, you can't go and do this and you can't do this for food, and then you give them no recourse on how to provide them with food, that's when the systems break down. And as a lot of us know, the systems aren't working hugely well when it comes to food security at the moment. Anyway, I'll move on. As I said, it's an election year. You can feel free to go and look at the policies of the various political parties yourself. There's also a few groups who do a good job of collating research. There's one called Vote for Kai, which is asking for political courage. Again, in some ways they are apolitical. They're not telling you to go vote for a political party, but they're telling you what are things that communities would like to see political parties have an emphasis on. And again, here it's around kind of producing food and making sure that people don't go hungry in New Zealand, which I think, as we said, is a basic human right that the government should be upholding according to their own policies and their own ruling. In a slightly smaller thing, I am organising a conference here at Palmerston North on the 21st of July, and it's called Kai o Ngā Tau Ki Mua, which is all around future food systems, and it'll be based on a bit about what we're talking today, and we're using the research I've shown you all today is a bit of a basis for that hui. And it's talking, and it's really, in some ways it's a really big networking event in terms of the network that Environment Network Manawatū are involved in. We're very strong in the community and in urban Palmerston North, but we're not too strong in the rural communities, and we're not too strong in the primary productive sector or in the farming sector, and that's something that we're really keen to do better at. Something I haven't mentioned here, but as part of food sovereignty, in terms of the food, something that's really important is that we value the people who produce the food, which is a really, seems like an obvious thing, but if we think about history and even like where some words, like the word peasant, you wouldn't really go up and call your friend a peasant, would you? It's not normally seen as a very nice word in some ways, but a peasant was used to describe people who produce and provide food for their communities, and they're very important, but often their work is overlooked. And so I think there's a perception out there that sometimes environmental structures and this kind of program I'm talking about does not align with farming and people producing the food, and I think that's rubbish, because I think there's a lot of crossover, I think there's a lot of alignment, and one of the things we'll be promoting at this week is about how we can do more to support local farmers, support local growers, and do more produce local food, eat local food. That's going to be a really big co-op event, and I'm hoping I can get people from a range of industries and organisations to come to it. So again, that could be a potential action of yours. I've got some posters for this. Maybe you've got children, grandchildren, friends who are in the primary productive sector, who are farmers. Tell them to come along to this. It's going to be really fun. It's going to be a lovely day. They'll get fed some locally produced kai. It is a ticketed event, so it does cost, unfortunately, to come along. But also, for any of you here, please feel free to come along if you have the capacity to buy a ticket and come along. We'd love to have your voice added to the group at the time. And again, there's going to be some sessions run by the researchers who have put together this group, put together the resource I shared with you today. So there are lots of options to be involved. So again, thank you so much for inviting me here and for finishing up the series on food and society. Really lovely to have you here, and I'll be available after the afternoon to either ask any questions and to talk any more. Thank you. Another question, which is talking about, I still don't quite understand resilience, food resilience, I think it is. And so storage of food is something that sits really well alongside food resilience. So when we're talking about food systems and we're talking about food resilience, you're able to kind of withstand disruptions to the supply, and it could be within a whānau. So as an example, if a whānau member loses their job, then they're going to probably face food insecurity because they no longer have an income. As a wider societal thing, along comes something like COVID and our transport systems get disrupted again. That's a big disruption, and we might not be able to get the lettuces or the carrots that come down from South Auckland, Pukekohe or something like that. So when we talk about resilience, we're talking about the ability to withstand disruptions in food supply. And if we go all the way back to over 20,000 years ago when we lived in these hunter-forager societies, disruptions happened every year. It was called winter. And in terms of seasonal kai and things, and so being able to store and preserve food was a really inherent part of human survival, to say the very least. If you couldn't store or preserve food over winter in the places where there was winter, if you weren't lucky enough to live in the tropical areas, you would actually not survive because you wouldn't have food. So coming to today's kind of area, food preservation is still really important. An example is kind of, if you go and buy tomatoes today, actually, even, I think they're probably getting up to almost over $8 a kilo again. If you get them in the middle of winter, I've seen them up to $15 a kilo. Going back a few months, I'm pretty sure I saw them for $2 a kilo a couple of times here. Like, it is seasonal, when people are not used to going with the seasons, in my opinion, and kind of knowing that actually food is produced according to a seasonal rhythm, and being able to buy the tomatoes when they're cheap and do some preserving, making the pasta sauce or whether it looks strawberries, making the strawberry jam, and then being able to preserve that and use it during winter when you wouldn't actually want to be buying fresh tomatoes or strawberries because they probably cost $10 for a hundred from Australia for strawberries, for example. That's just some specific examples of why it is really important to have those skills around the storing and preserving food and how that relates to food resilience. So hopefully I've answered two questions in one there. Another one here, it says that you focus on food production. What about the social dimension of food preparation and consumption? Yeah, I probably did it. And again, that's a huge part of why food is so important, is that if we're thinking outside the area of actually going to the supermarket and buying food or buying takeaways and eating it, if you're actually talking about the whole cycle of growing the food amongst your whānau probably, or amongst the community garden, the harvesting it, the sharing the knowledge, all of the social interactions that go on at every single stage of that journey from growing the food, preparing it, maybe storing it, to eating it, is there's so many more opportunities for social interactions and those connections to be made, as opposed to when you're just using food as a commercialised product. So yes, I probably did kind of go over that. I probably underplayed the role of the social interactions, but they are huge. And again, something I probably underplayed in this was the links to health, both mental and physical health, in terms of food systems where people are involved in communities. They're huge benefits to, like, not only eating food that is fresh and healthy, but actually being physically active in the preparation of the food, being socially active in the groups and the people who are involved in that food. So there's huge health benefits, and I think that's becoming more and more apparent, and that could be a way in to get some of that long-term sustainable funding that we mentioned as a barrier to kind of food initiatives. So that's something that we're actively looking at the moment in our region, in our organisation. How would I get myself involved in a community garden? Great question. At the moment, if you search for ENM, Environment Network Manawatū, don't go to the first tip for ENM, because it's possibly called ethical non-monogamy, which is around having relationships with more than one person. We're not that in ENM, we're Environment Network Manawatū. And we do have in there a list under the food sovereignty. We've got a little bar about community gardens there. So you could do that. Alternatively, feel free to pop in our office at 145 Cuba Street, or give us a ring, and if you get hold of me, I can give you some information. So there's very active gardens over, if you happen to be in the Roslyn area, there's the Roslyn Commons, who operate at Cuba Reserve, very active. Awakuni Community Gardens operate in more kind of allotment style, so families get given a plot of garden that they grow in. There are some communal ones there. There's a lot of community gardens often have slightly different kaupapa and different kind of, I suppose, like the reasons for what they do. And again, it's good to find one. I suppose local is always good, but also find one that aligns with your values. So are you going there to kind of be involved in a community setting? Are you going there because you want to provide food for yourself and your whānau? There are possibly quite different gardens you need to go to. But we do have a directory on our website, which we're updating kind of at the moment about that sort of thing, about what the different community gardens are doing. What is the difference between processed food and ultra-processed food? Examples of ultra-processed food. So, I'm not quite a nutrition expert, but I think if you Google it, something like the difference between processed and ultra-processed is, once you get to ultra-processed, I think there's something like this, often like a rule of thumb, something like it's often more than 7 ingredients, and 2 or 3 of them are things that you probably haven't heard of that have got numbers and colours and things next to them. So examples are things like packets of chips or crisps or most biscuits you buy in packets, things that are kind of long life type products. Again, other ways, like a can of tomatoes probably isn't ultra processed, and it's long life, but maybe like a fresh packaged meal, it's a bit tricky. But in general, ultra processed foods are ones that you kind of tend not to recognise what type of plant or animal they originated from. It's another kind of a thing there. So yeah, I'm probably not the best person to answer, so but rather than say I don't know, I'll try to give you a couple of examples. So hopefully I've done that one a bit of justice. Next one, this is a big question. It says, it looks like small-scale food production compared to commercial farming market gardens. Is it viable? Is it designed to run in parallel to commercial? Yes, is the short answer to that. Long answer. So if you look at kind of worldwide in terms of where food comes from, I think there's quite a startling figure, and I'm not going to give you the exact number, but something like 70% of food produced worldwide is produced within like a couple of kilometres of where it's grown. Most food that people eat in most societies worldwide is grown in small-scale production. It's actually, when we talk about quantity, like bulk weight of food, it's actually a relatively small amount that's produced by a very large kind of agricultural Western systems, but that's the kind of food that often, like, kind of produce that often ends up in things like the ultra-processed food, and is often what we think of mainly is food in Western societies, but it's done in many other countries. So yes, it can be done. It's not going to happen straight away because the existing system is so big and we couldn't actually flip a switch and do it overnight. And I think about the running in parallel, I think that's a really pertinent question, because yes, I think what I see in my head when I visualize it is like, this is the big food system that operates at the moment, which is commercialized and quite entrenched in our society, and this is the community food system in the middle, where it's small and it's growing, and there's a few links. So like Just Silk, for example, have very good links. That's a community organization who have links to both community gardens and to the commercial kind of supermarket chains and things. And it's small, but it's growing, and the more people we get involved in the community gardens and small scale growing, the more people value having locally produced food, and the more they're willing to spend that money, the more opportunities there are for local growers to then create businesses on growing that food. And again, when I talk about that, the Hui that I'm running in July, I'm hopefully going to have a couple of really good speakers from a local organisation called Live to Give Organics, who produce food that is grown in a small scale way, in a very environmentally sustainable way. They sell direct to producers. They also kind of get food from other producers in the region and they sell through the website. So that's an example that we've been very successfully in our region. Those are all the written questions I've had, but I'm very happy to open the floor to any other questions.
While I'm taking the mic over, New Zealand's reliant on agricultural exports. Are we doing the wrong thing there?
I think we are over-reliant. I think we put too much focus on it. I mean, this is just personally. And I think that there are ways to do things better in it. It might not necessarily be... I mean, if every farmer had 10% of their land was dedicated to crops or something that went to New Zealand mouths to feed, we would live in a very different world in terms of food security and insecurity in our region, because there is a big focus on export-dominated kind of markets, and that often comes at the expense. I mean, again, we all know when we see the ridiculous things like we get butter imported from overseas that's cheaper than butter produced in New Zealand. I mean, like, really? I mean, like, what system do we have? So, yeah, things are broken in many ways, and I think that, again, kind of, we're all governed by rules and regulations, and it comes back to our leaders and the political systems and what policies we support. Sorry, I'll go back to that question.
A couple of things that concern me about food security. One of them is the preponderance that we have to sell our food processing systems to offshore people, who then close them down and the primary producers have got nowhere to put their produce. So we're going to end up jamming ourselves into a really big corner at some stage in the future. And the other aspect about that is the stupidity that goes on in the planning world, where we put subdivisions on the most fertile land that we've got, park market gardens, and then we don't wonder why the hell we can't feed it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with both those comments, and again, kind of in terms of sometimes it comes down to rules and regulations. Like it's, yeah, we all heard the news about the Watties factories closing down and the farmers who provide them, and again, thinking, what? How? Why? How have we let this as a society happen when we have these farmers and primary producers reliant on probably an overseas-owned corporation that shuts them down? And again, yeah, it's a bit of a mess, and we can do a lot better. And a lot of things come down to, again, this is why I'm trying to be very apolitical. I'm not telling you who to vote for, and I won't. But please be aware of the different policies that different parties have on food systems, and whether they have any or not, whether it's actually even a priority of them. If it's not a priority, maybe that's something to take note of.
Just a little observation. When I've been on trips out and about, I can't help but notice, and I don't know whether it's a recent thing, I can't go back into my memory what it was like in the years before, but you travel around the countryside, and it just looks like, what on earth is this land being used for? I can't actually see what's there, and in fact I have passed by some lands where I see herds of wild goats as if they're part of what's been planted. And I'm thinking, I don't know whether you have a comment on this. What's happening to our land?
In general, I mean, there's been a trend. If you look at land use over the last, 20 years, there's definitely been a trend to convert to dairy, kind of New Zealand wide, and particularly in some regions more than others. Due to basic economics, like if a farmer can earn more You know, I'm not in a farm bashing here or anything like this, because people have to make a living. And if a farmer cannot make a living on their 40 acres or 40 hectares doing sheep or sheep and beef or kind of market gardens and things, they have to go, they have to make a living somehow. And if dairy is the only way to do it, that's what they will do. And the systems have been set in place for the last 20 years, basically, or longer than that, have been, I suppose, encouraging people and land use to go into a certain direction. And again, when we talk about dairy, because that's very export orientated, for every hectare of land that's converted from, let's say, a market garden into dairy farms, that's food that is not going to end up in New Zealand, that is now going overseas. So again, and this comes back to the, when I talked about the group, which is the Vote for Kai, one of the things they're advocating for is actually just a coherent food system in New Zealand that's not completely reliant on being market driven in a capitalist society. Capitalism is driving the markets, and it doesn't always drive it in directions that work for us as a society. And so what they're saying is, hey, let's have a government policy of what we want our food systems to be and look like, and how can we work towards that. And as of yet, no government has actually ever done that.
You didn't talk much about education. I have strong feelings about the link between food and health. And I believe people don't make the right choices because they don't have the knowledge to know about the right choices. I have strong feelings about the government to put on a campaign, as they did for non-smoking, to encourage people to eat the right foods. I think they would save a lot of money in the health service if they had people more informed about what they're eating.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Anna. I think that comes back to what I was talking around about when I mentioned the behaviour change around, in order to change people's behaviour, it's that kind of three-pronged approach. Not only do you need them to know what to do, you need to give them the tools to do it, and they need the kind of support from external influences. And if we're talking about food and education around food and what people choose to eat at the moment, if they go to a supermarket and then say, like, the apple is there for $2 and the packet of chips is there for $1, then that's not going to encourage them to eat the apple. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, and again, kind of with all the advertising coming from them, you don't see the adverts kind of in the middle watching your streaming TV saying, come and buy this apple or this banana, or go to your community garden to get some lettuce or anything, because there's no money in that. They can't advertise it. It's only from the companies and organisations that make the money. So you're absolutely right that that in terms of behaviour change, education is huge, yeah, and I don't want to underplay the role, because we have a lot of really great organisations who do the education, whether it's Plant to Plate, whether it's Supergrams, whether it is Enviro Schools or Recap, or these many, many groups that put so much time and effort in, but often they're up against this wall of what are the resources that people are available, what's this huge food industry that can spend millions of dollars into advertising and things. So it's tricky, and education is hugely important, but we can't forget about the other factors that drive behaviour change and kind of influence they have too.
Okay, any more questions? Okay, well, on behalf of U3A and everyone else here, I'd like to thank you very much for giving the fourth session in the series. It's been a very successful series, and there's been the comments people have been making to me, they've been fascinated with what you had to say. I hope they're motivated to get involved and do all the sorts of things you're trying to promote, but it's nice to see so much that's going on. And on behalf of everyone here, a small thank you for what you've done.